Okay, well, thank you for attending the 2020 Sunstone Digital Symposium, Session 316, titled Feminist Genealogy as Spiritual Practice. The audio from this session will be available for purchase at sunstone.org after the symposium, and the video recording of this session will be available in the Whova app for the remainder of 2020. So at Sunstone, we're making it a goal to build a community that allows many ways for people to express their faith. Our tagline is, there's more than one way to Mormon. We invite you to help us build a community where all paths are given space to be better understood. Please support us in our mission by making a donation and subscribing at sunstone.org. So about this presentation, owning our story can be an important step in transforming grief to gratitude. Learn about ways to engage feminist genealogy as a way to connect with your story, find your voice, and wrestle with complicated intersections of history, spirituality, and meaning. I'm just going to introduce you to our speaker before we begin. Ariel Wu-Tan Merkling is a 30-something mother of two who enjoys social work, libraries, and making tamales. Her dislikes include whales, laundry, and writing bios. In LCSW, she has a private therapy practice in Springville, Utah. So I'm going to now turn it over to Ariel. And actually, since we're doing this a little bit differently today, I will be sharing her slides for her here.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Jen, for moderating for us today. I really appreciate it. And thanks to all of you who are participating in this early morning Saturday session. Today, if we could go to the next slide. Today, I wanted to share in our session some information about my personal journey to finding feminist genealogy as spiritual practice. All I know is my own story, and so I'm going to share that. But my hope is that it gives you, I'm also going to share some ideas, some things that I've learned about engaging with genealogy from a feminist standpoint. That will hopefully be applicable or interesting or supportive of folks who are interested in doing the same. I'm hoping that through this discussion, it can also create space for ideas for revisiting traditions to find new meaning from them as you engage with them in a full and authentic way. So hopefully it will give a couple of different ideas there. And then presentation is also rooted in my, you know, deeply held belief that the personal is political. And so by sharing my story, I'm hopeful that it can give some thoughts and feedback on how our personal story also connects with larger bigger questions, and in addition to that, spiritual component. So if we can move to the next slide. So my personal journey with feminist genealogy as spiritual practice really started in 2014. In 2014, gave birth to my first son, and I had a lot of medical complications while in the hospital. And in part, a lot of those complications were made more difficult by the fact that I struggled to use my voice in that environment to advocate for myself or to feel like I was able to do so. And so in terms of my postpartum recovery, it was kind of a perfect storm of anxiety, postpartum depression. I had a double recovery from labor and having a C-section. My son was struggling with a lip and tongue tie that we didn't know about. And so he was having difficulty with eating, and I was on a lot of painkillers. And so it was kind of this perfect storm of lots of things that were very difficult. And so in the beginning of 2015, we had our baby blessing at the local LDS chapel. And the blessing went beautifully. Everything was was fine. But after the baby blessing, my son was feeling hungry and fussy and all those things that babies do. And so I took him to the nursing mother's lounge in the chapel. And I had, I'm sure many of you have seen these. This is not the exact room, but one that's very similar to it. Very utilitarian. You know, there's not a lot of, it's kind of like a classroom that was not even refurbished, just kind of had these chairs in it. And I had this moment of really acute disorientation. At the time, you know, this being able to feed my son through nursing was a really central experience in my life. It was taking a lot of my time, my energy, my physical effort. It was something that was impacting me in this like very moment to moment, day to day kind of way, hour to hour. It was something that was on my mind a lot, a central experience to my life at the time. And here in the church building, the room or the space that I was being given to do so was really kind of an afterthought, a side note, or even like an unnecessary auxiliary. And so I had this like really, really disorientation or disconnect between what I was going through and what my spiritual needs were and what I was getting kind of in the church community and environment. And so I became really engaged with this search and this attempt to make spiritual meaning of my experience, to find this connection. It was something that I desperately needed, and I had this deep hunger for. So that journey kind of led me to a couple different places. So Jen, if we could go to the next slide. And this image is from Anna Killian, from her art project at BYU, which was called Her. This is one component of this series of images and projects in her, or combination of images and words from a number of different Mormon women. I started in this search for spiritual meaning with connection, searching for connection with Heavenly Mother. And this, the Divine Feminine in the LDS tradition, especially among Mormon feminists, is a very strong one. And so there was a lot of, not a ton, but there was information and people who've already engaged in that work. So that's where I started. But I personally found, and this was the submission that I made for this art project. I think it cut off. Yeah, it cut off. My name is at the bottom. But I found that as I engaged with this search, this aspect of the search, that I had a very difficult time connecting spiritually with Heavenly Mother. I'm not sure exactly why this is, but as I've continued to stay involved in the conversation, I think that I may not be the only person who struggled with that connection. As I've done some research, the research suggests that early attachment style can be something that can impact our connection with the divine. So with either Heavenly Father, Heavenly Mother, if we have a difficulty in our early attachment relationships, so that can impact it. For others, the question of eternal polygamy can be a wound, makes it difficult to connect with Heavenly Mother. For folks in the LGBTQIA plus community, the idea of compulsory heterosexuality can be really painful and really wounding, and can make it difficult to connect with her. I'm not sure where I land in that, but I also know that I'm not the only one. But as I was connecting with this, I kept hitting this place of spiritual silence. And so I took that to be the message in and of itself. I engaged in a lot of meditation at that time. I engaged with the idea that the silence for me was this message of not of Heavenly Mother not speaking over me, and I used that space to explore using my own voice and finding my own voice. So I had some really cool experiences with this, but it didn't really fulfill this ache that I had for spiritual meaning out of my complicated birth experience. So if we can, Jen, go to the next slide. And so as I was continuing to search, I came upon this idea of engaging with genealogy. So in this, the idea kind of came to me in this desire to understand women's experiences, to find validation or context or understanding for what I had been going through. And so I began to become really interested in my direct maternal line. So that is like my mother, grandmother, great-grandmother. So, but going in direct maternal meaning, so my mother's mother, my grandmother's mother, great-grandmother's mother, kind of in that direction. I became really interested in researching that line. And as I began to engage with this, I found that there were a lot of holes in my understanding. It was very common for me to find that that as I tried to research this direct maternal line, it was frequently being redirected to the paternal line. And there's a lot of reasons for that, in part because the women's name changes throughout history, in especially Western society, which is where my direct line goes through, those name changes make it difficult to trace women because their maiden name is not always recorded. And then there was also this issue of records when women weren't allowed to do things like own property or even in the early census. The census of 1800 and the census of 1790, at those points, women weren't even designated by name in the census. They went by household, and they had a tick mark system for how many women were there in the household between these ages. So we don't even have names at that point, which makes it very, very difficult. So as I started to engage with this is a picture of my maternal grandmother and my daughter, which is very, very meaningful for me. But I began to connect with her. She's the person in our family who has a lot of the oral tradition and a lot of the history. She's very familiar with it. And so I began to connect with her, and we started to set up these genealogy dates where, you know, we'd sit down and she'd bring out her pictures and things like that. And I began to really develop this very fierce connection with my maternal grandmother, which has really been a wonderful thing in my life. Even though we were very, very different in a lot of ways, this fierce connection had more to do with things that it was based in things that really transcended a lot of those differences. So it's very meaningful for me. So I'm going to go through, as I started this journey, I'm going to go through some of the key things that were helpful for me in engaging in with genealogy, feminist genealogy as spiritual practice. So Jen, if you could go to the next slide. The thing that I started with was to start where I was. So you don't want to dive into the deep end and get discouraged and overwhelmed. But it's really, really helpful to be aware of, to kind of take stock at the beginning of this process. So one of the things that I think is really important to be aware of and to acknowledge is how much privilege plays a part in genealogy and the accessibility of records. So when family lines are interrupted by things like genocide, diaspora, even more things that happen on a more personal level, things like domestic violence, where you have family members pick up, move states, change names, you know, to try to escape, even immigration, refugee status, all of those kinds of things can make access to records really, really difficult. And so sometimes, you know, based on, and I'm thinking specifically in the U.S., the records of white settler colonizers are kept a lot better than the records of indigenous communities and people and people who were impacted by chattel slavery and brought to the U.S. In that way. So families, depending on privilege, are very, very impacted by the accessibility of records. That being said, even if those barriers are something that you can anticipate, doesn't mean that you can't engage in this practice. In a lot of LDS families, you're going to find that there's this attitude or thought process that our genealogy is already done, or that, and you know, we have that one family member who's really passionate about it, and they're kind of the keeper of the stories, and that can be sometimes a barrier to wanting to engage in this as a spiritual practice. But if we're looking at it through the lens of feminism, we're going to be aware that who tells the story and who keeps the story and who curates the story, the stories in our families, is going to impact the messages and the lessons and the meaning that is given to those stories. So just because someone has looked at these stories or collected them or collected the data and the information about family members does not necessarily mean that that is the only perspective on those stories. And it's still very vital that you bring your authentic self to these stories of your ancestors to connect with them, because a different perspective can be really, really meaningful. So it's also important to recognize that we're working with very, very complex human beings. And so the complexity of our ancestors and acknowledging their full humanity is going to be a theme that I'll continue to talk about. But what it does is these stories really hit on our core identity of who we are and where we come from. And so genealogy will bring up these issues of wanted identities and unwanted identities and really sometimes challenge them, because our ancestors are, you know, full, complete human beings. And so they don't always fit neatly into a box. And so when we're dealing with these core identity issues, the wanted and unwanted identities, it's going to potentially trigger some issues of shame or embarrassment, or make us kind of grapple with our assumptions about what is wanted and unwanted. And that, I think, can be really, really meaningful. It's a little bit messy. It's a little bit uncomfortable at times, but so, so meaningful and so fruitful. So I think that in this slide, the question of what stories make you uncomfortable and why, those are going to be places where there's a lot of growth potential, and a lot of really meaningful personal work can happen around those types of stories. So looking at, you know, kind of assessing what are you looking for, what are you specifically interested in. For me, it was these stories of motherhood, because that was kind of where what I was grappling with, this spiritual meaning of mothers and children, and especially mothers and daughters. Those types of things were really important to me. Assessing what primary sources are available, not just, so oral history is important. If you have access to journals, census records, all those kinds of things, like what are those primary sources? And not just taking someone else's word for it, but going back to that text and really looking at it. Then it's okay to also be aware of your current bandwidth, because, you know, there's going to be times in your life when you can engage in this in at different levels, and that's okay. Okay, Genevieve, we can go to the next slide. So if you are in a situation where you're anticipating that there's a lot of barriers to your access for these records based on things like privilege, I want you to know that doesn't mean that we can't engage with this feminist genealogy in a really interesting way. It just means that we want to start with the self and start with the living family members and records. So in Christine Northrup's Women's Body, Women's Wisdom, she talks about there being five primary stages of transition in a woman's life. And this is obviously not universal, but just kind of a general thing. So these five stages are birth, menstruation, motherhood, menopause, and death. So as you kind of look at those are five types of themes that we can explore as we're looking at feminist genealogy, at questioning ourselves, questioning our living relatives, that kind of stuff. We want to really center on the female experience, which is marked and which is really important, made important by these distinct transformational periods. And obviously, you know, those five stages are not, they don't have to be literal necessarily, and they don't have to be, it just kind of gives this idea that there are periods of transition and exploring what that is like. So I put up some sample questions here. These are obviously not the only ones or the only examples, but just as a couple of things that you could think about. I put these questions in a way that are easy to discuss with family members who are kind of all across the spectrum in terms of spirituality and orthodoxy and all that kind of stuff, because what I found is that when we really center on the personal, that connection can be really powerful, because even though the personal is political, it's also the personal. And so it creates this like really strong connection when you're asking someone about their specific experience. So questions about, you know, what do you know about your own birth story, childhood, traditions in your family about menarche, first period, menstruation, how did you learn about that? How did you know about it? What was your first experience like? Those kinds of things. Obviously not all women experience that. And so, you know, tailor it to the person, but asking questions about courtship and marriage the process of learning about sex education, assumptions about it, coming of age traditions, birth, baby showers, birth recovery, traditions around that. I really love the question of who are your female spiritual mentors. And I've found that to be a really meaningful and interesting question to discuss with family members. So as we center more and more on the personal, we're going to find that to be really open up people to sharing, because these personal stories are really important. They're really, you know, who we are and what we're about. Okay, so if we can go to the next slide. So this is a concept that I came to learn about, which is I kind of titled this Ask the Next Question. So the picture behind it is from an article in the Relief Society magazine in 1943, and as I was looking into my family history, I found that my maternal line, I lived in Arizona. So they immigrated after being taught the gospel by a missionary via railroad. Came to Utah, stayed there for a few years, and then immigrated south to Arizona. And so I was looking for more information about what that experience was like, more information about the community, kind of the history of the community. And I found this article in the Relief Society magazine. So written after the fact. And in this article, it's called Crossing the River into Arizona. And there's this discussion of how part of this process was crossing the Grand Canyon to get to these communities in Arizona. And so I thought this was really fascinating. This is a very dramatic story of like imagining trying to like get a wagon full of people, you know, down the canyon and across the river. It was very, very exciting for me. So I took this information to my grandmother, who she lived and grew up in this community and was very aware of it, the kind of culture and norms there. So she was this really vital piece for me to understanding the experience of these grandmothers. And she looked at it and she said, "Ariel, this is ridiculous. No one would have crossed the Grand Canyon when there's a crossing. It was so easy up north. And so you could cross the river way before it became the canyon, before the canyon got carved like very, very deep." So she was like, "I don't think this is like super accurate." And so as you know, she talked about Lee's Ferry being this crossing that was very common, that was more north. So at the place where the Colorado River is more shallow before it carves the depths of the Grand Canyon. So I started to ask kind of the questions about like this story, and it was clear that it wasn't, I don't believe it was, you know, in any way personally misleading. I think that those early explorers may have crossed in that way, or maybe individuals. But as a general rule, it wasn't the norm to cross across the Grand Canyon. But as I began to look into this and to other research around this time period, I found that there was a deep feeling of a need to legitimize this experience of having left Utah to go to Arizona, and it made more sense to me as I discussed it with a volunteer at the Church History Library while I was looking up some information, where I was talking to them about this person about this move to Arizona, and in our family oral tradition, our family was called there by the prophet, so the prophet would request people to go. When I was speaking with this volunteer, she said, or missionary there, she said, "No, that never happened. That wasn't a thing." And this like outright dismissal, you know, I noticed in myself, it was like, no, this is legitimate. This is for real. I found that in a lot of articles about, also about railroad pioneers, so people who joined the church and migrated to Utah after the railroads were built. And there's this, you know, these articles and these historical reviews and things like that were so focused on the legitimacy of that. And, you know, we see that even in the church's database, where they have a database of overland pioneers, but it goes from this date to this date and stops. And then all of those records are not curated in the same way for people who weren't considered overland pioneers. So people who traveled via sea or via railroad have this feeling or this urge or this need to legitimize their experience and say, "We are just as valid, you know, we are just as important or just as pioneery." I don't know if that's a word, but as those overland pioneers. And so, you know, here we see this kind of wanted and unwanted identities coming up. So we want, especially as we're looking at primary sources, we want to be thoughtful and ask the next question. So who's the source of the information? Why did they write it? What might be their purpose? How reliable is the source? Are there other perspectives to consider, other viewpoints of the experience or the story? And how might it look different from the other side, or the other story? How might this person be using their agency to navigate difficult systems, rules, or norms of their day? Whose story do we have access to, and whose story do we not have access to, and why? And does the story, is it being used to reinforce or challenge social norms or power structures? So another interesting experience of this, where I was kind of engaging with asking me some of these questions, was my great great grandmother. She got married to a man who is not a member of the church, and she had been dating someone who was a member of the church, and we have this letter in German, and it's been translated because her husband was a German immigrant, but this again was happening before they got married. where he writes to his friend who's still in the town. He left to go to California for a little time during their courtship. And during that time, she was going to dances, things like that. And the message that he had gotten from other people in the town was that she was engaged to this LDS boy. And there was a lot of distress. But we don't have the letter that he wrote to his friend. We have to read the letter that his friend wrote him in California, you know, kind of reassuring him that no, she wasn't engaged, that it was kind of a complicated situation, that this other LDS boy was anticipating that they were going to get married. And so he went out and bought a house and furnished it and set a date and all these things, but that she was never on board with that date. And so she kind of like refused him, even though everyone had thought that they were going to be together. And he's kind of writing to encourage, to let him know like that she's still being true to him and that they're still in a relationship and things like that. And so, you know, the story that we have is only one side of it. We don't, you know, as I thought about it, I don't have the story of the perspective of the person who got dumped essentially. And, you know, I don't even have the I imagine frantic letter written from her husband, you know, eventual husband, to his friend, where he's like, "What is going on?" You know, and that would be really, really fascinating. But we don't have all of those pieces of the story. What we have is really intriguing, but not the whole picture. And so, just kind of being aware of that, and knowing that there might have been more than one perspective on what happened, and we don't have this grandmother, her story, written down, in any way that I'm aware of, where she tells her side of the story. So, you know, was this other person trying to pressure her, or coerce her into a relationship? Was she leading him on? I mean, I just don't know, but asking those next questions and being aware that what we have is only one piece or one viewpoint, can be really meaningful and helpful to understanding a little bit of a deeper and connecting in a deeper way. Okay, if we can go to the next slide. So one of the most, I think, spiritually meaningful things that I've learned in this practice of family history is learning to embrace the both and. So two things can be true at the exact same time, and learning to hold that without them canceling each other out, to hold both truths, has been really, really powerful and really meaningful for me. So the picture on this slide is of the grave of my direct maternal ancestor, Emily Elizabeth Rose, and she lived between 1817 and 1885. And her story is a really, really complex one, and it really caused me to grapple with some of these wanted and unwanted identities and the complexity of her as a human being. So she was born in upstate New York, lived there, married her husband there, had her entire family complete. All of her children were born in New York. And at the age of 49, she and her husband and her children packed up everything that they had and moved from upstate New York to Michigan. And it was a very, you know, interesting journey. Not sure if they went by boat or by land up through Canada. Both people oftentimes went both ways, but really, really fascinating. She made this move at the age of 49, and which is really, really amazing to me, you know, that she picked up everything and moved this really extensive distance for her time and for her availability and access to transportation and things like that. She really left behind her family, who she was very close with. And so, but at this point in her life, where starting over is maybe not the norm or what's expected. She was also the first person, the first female in my maternal line to own property. And this was only made possible by a very recent law that was passed in Michigan that happened just shortly before her husband died. So when he died young, I believe, you know, we don't have details, but, you know, it's possible that it was due to accident or injury, but I'm not sure. When he died, she was able to retain their family farm and continue to work it and to live there. Whereas, you know, just a few years earlier, she wouldn't have been allowed to do that. So things that I really admire about her and find really intriguing and engaging and really respect and honor. As I continue to dig into her story, one of the things that I realized and learned was that the land that she owned, the way that she and her husband came into possession of that was very complicated. So in Michigan, the land that she lived on in Hinton, Michigan, had been lived on and possessed and caretaken by the Ojibwe Indian community for a very long time. And it was only made available to her and her husband through the Indian Relocation Act of 1830. And so this act was put into place by the president at the time, who was Andrew Jackson. And this act made it possible, permissible, legal to expel, to have forced expulsions of indigenous communities and individuals, and then forced a lot of land secessions. So where tribes were kind of forced to give up land in order to obtain, you know, their basic necessities of life. And so this is a lot more complicated, a lot more problematic, obviously, of how they came to own the land. So I was grappling with this, you know, I realized that a lot of this removal had happened before my ancestors got there. So they were not actively participating in genocide, but they were actively benefiting from it. And then as I, you know, continued to look at the records, I saw that they named their one of their sons, Andrew Jackson Rose. So their last name was Rose, but Andrew Jackson Rose, after this president who had committed and encouraged a lot of genocide and forced removals. So hugely, hugely, you know, uncomfortable for me, because that's not something that I feel is really positive. And so I had to kind of hold these two things to be true at the exact same time. The truth that this person, this ancestor of mine, Emily Elizabeth Rose, was very, very compelling and had done these really amazing things in terms of starting over this late point in her life, in terms of being the first female ancestor to own property. Those things were true, and at the same time, she benefited from genocide, forced expulsions, land cessation, and that she also held in a lot of respect the president who made that possible. And both of those things are true at the exact same time, and they don't cancel each other out, but they both exist. The other thing that this was really meaningful for me was to kind of look at how this move affected their family. So in the sense between, you can look at the two censuses, the 1860 and then 1870, they moved in the middle of that. In 1860, you know, prior to that, their family had never owned land. So Emily and her husband had never owned land. Their kids, they lived on different families' farms. They were classified as laborers, not as farmers or landowners. And at one point, they tried shoemaking as a profession to try to move their family forward. In 1860, the family had $25 to their name in terms of their wealth. But when they made this move to Michigan and were able to own land for the first time, that resulted in an increase of their family net worth went from $25 to $700 during that 10 year period. So that's a percent increase of over 2,000%, which is intense and amazing. That, you know, a huge amount. And so I look at that and see, you know, that they were trying to make a decision that was putting their family in a better place, and I can honor that. And at the same time, hold that, that benefit to them came at the cost and trauma and death and negative impacts for indigenous communities, especially of the Ojibwe people. And so, you know, I can hold both of those things. It also helped me to understand and to really become aware of the fact that it's okay to be compassionate towards people and also really hard on the systems that put them in these kinds of situations. I was able to learn about how low-income white Americans were pitted against racial minorities as a way to say, you know, their negative or hurt or harm is your benefit, and how compelling that argument was and how effective. So I was able to become very critical of settler colonialism, capitalism, all of these things that kind of pushed them to feel like this was their only choice. And also to be very aware that there were people at the time who were able to make different decisions, who said, I don't care if I don't get ahead, I don't think it's okay to commit genocide. And to be aware of that, of who at the time was being critical of what was going on. So we want to be aware of the impulse to redeem the ancestors that we connect with, ignore, whitewash, you know, kind of push away the complexity of them. And honoring our ancestors can mean things like reparations, you know, supporting Indigenous folks who are dealing with the trauma that was the result of my ancestors' benefit. Jen, can we go to the next slide? So the next skill that I want to talk about that is really, really helpful is the idea of being able to start to be creative and inventive when we hit these barriers and roadblocks on understanding our ancestors and having access to their information. And so I call this reading between the lines. So we may not have a lot of data and information, but we can expand our search and look at larger pictures. So the ancestors that are pictured here are my direct maternal line, Camilla Rose and Polly Thompson. And so these are mother and daughter. So the picture is of the mother and the daughter, and then that black and white, the very stark picture of her standing is her grown up, that child grown up. And so this mother-daughter pair is really fascinating to me. We don't have a lot of primary sources about them. Neither one of them kept a journal that we have any access to. There were some in the oral history, some reports of letters that were written, but they were destroyed in a flood that destroyed Polly's home when she was an adult. So we lost a lot of that written record. Polly also had to learn to read and write as an adult after she arrived in Utah, at least according to the census. She didn't have that ability until later. So we don't have I don't have access to a lot of primary sources about either of these women. And so I can kind of zoom out and look at the larger picture. Some of the things that I did know are that Polly and her patriarchal blessing was given the gift of healing. And in our oral tradition, as I talked to my grandmother about it, I was told that she became a midwife and that she never lost a child, any birth that she attended. And so a fascinating thing to find out. So I was able to kind of, even though I didn't have her personal history, I was able to do some research and learning about what midwifery in Arizona looked like at the time. And I was able to, if you have Mormon ancestry, you may want to look at the Church History Library. They have a lot of resources that I wasn't anticipating. For instance, Polly, they have all of the Relief Society meeting notes of the ward that she attended. And so I was able to find, it wasn't any of her words, but the words of the secretary, the Relief Society secretary that was sitting in the room with her. And so to hear some of the things that she contributed, the comments she made in classes, you know, just they're very small things, but every connection with her voice was really, really powerful for me. And so knowing that that she participated in a Relief Society meeting, that was one where they discussed bringing someone in to teach them about midwifery. I can kind of see what her training looked like. And then as I was able to learn and read more about what others did, what that looked like for other women who did keep journals, I was able to get a better picture of it. Some fascinating things such as, I was able to learn about the practice of blessing women during the early stage of labor or during confinement, I believe is what they called it, and women blessing other women and what that looked like and what that typically, the format that was typically used. Again, I'm looking more at these historical documents from other people, but that gave me more of a perspective of what that might have looked like for her. The other fascinating thing was that I learned that it was not uncommon for Mormon midwives during the birth period to not only be there during labor, but to also stay for 2 weeks afterwards and support the family and kind of take over the day-to-day running of the household so that the new mother and child could engage in some bonding time. Fascinating. So, so, so cool. So interesting. As I looked at all of these different things, I was able to increase and feel this real deep connection to this mother-daughter pair of midwives who both went together to deliver babies. Was really, really powerful for me. When I was at the Church History Library and reading about them and reading the secretary notes about what they said and seeing them, the notes about their Relief Society dues and paid 25 cents a year and things like that. It was really, really powerful. I found that not even noticing that I was feeling this very warm connection. Kind of like when you're snuggled up in a blanket and you're just feeling like all toasty warm, you know. And then as I gave back the records and the forms to the Church History Library, you know, I was looking at them in the room, handing them back, I found that I began to tear up because I felt the sensation of this warm blanket being taken off. That I hadn't even noticed was there. This connection was really, really powerful. And so because of this, I really encourage you to engage with any heirlooms, artifacts, traditions. Can you have experience with the actual land that your ancestors were on? It's really, really powerful. Jen, if we could go to the next slide. Then spiritual practice can move us to action or can include an action component. In the LDS tradition, there's a very strong tradition of family history pilgrimage. And so I've put up a couple of pictures from a genealogy trip that I took. My family still lives in upstate New York, and so I was able to stay with them and use that as a base of operations to engage in some of this, which was really wonderful. And so the picture is of my right now it's the furthest back maternal ancestor that I can verify. Her name is also Polly, not the same Polly. Grandmother of the previous ancestor that I put up on the slide. We went to the town of Sardinia, New York, where she lived for most of her adult life, and looking for her gravestone. And so we went to the local cemetery, searched the whole thing, completely unable to find any trace of her or her family. And so we were driving through town, you know, after we'd kind of given up, and there was a little town historian office that had a sign out. So we pulled in, you know, very impulsively. No one was there. We knocked, no one was there, but they had a phone number. So we called the number. The local town historian was two doors down just getting his hair cut. And so he said, yeah, you know, sure, I'll come for a family history emergency. And wonderful, you know, it was so wonderful of him to do that. And he showed us that there was another cemetery in town that I wasn't aware of. And we searched the entire thing. We were able to find her husband and her son's headstone, but were unable to find hers. And I knew it had been there, and we searched and searched and were feeling really discouraged. And all of a sudden, someone in our group found that her headstone had fallen, and there were I probably would have been nervous that something would break, but they were brave enough to pick it up. And we were able to see the headstone there. Someone had to probably turn it upside down so that it wouldn't get worn. And so we could still have access to it. So this was a really, really amazing experience. And I found that I just kept putting my hand on this great headstone and feeling this very, very deep connection and this feeling of coming home, which I associate really strongly with this ancestor, this grandmother of mine, because that was a really powerful experience for me. As we look at different types of action that this spiritual practice can move us towards, I found that for me, identifying themes of intergenerational trauma and scarcity is a really big intergenerational trauma theme. I saw this definitely during the recent pandemic when it kind of first came up, and where I was seeing everyone, the stores were just, the shelves were completely bare. And I found that that's a common response of intergenerational trauma to scarcity. One that I definitely resonated with and understood, but our ancestors responded to scarcity with hoarding. Hoarding is probably a strong word, but by taking and keeping additional, so just in case. And so, I saw that very much as an intergenerational trauma response, and helped me to understand better my responses and also to understand this is an area of healing work that I can do. We believe in proxy healing work, in the LDS tradition. So I take that to mean also, kind of trauma healing work can happen proxy for these intergenerational themes. If your ancestors dealt with refugee status or domestic violence or, these themes that might come out, those are things that you can actively get involved with and support. I loved my husband during the marriage equality kind of conversation, really resonated with the fact that he would tell people, my ancestors fled the country in order to marry the way that they wanted to, in terms of, talking about this Mormon heritage of polygamy, but connected it to the LGBT, marriage equality today, and saying, this is something I feel very comfortable supporting. So, we can kind of build our empathy as we connect with our ancestor stories to people who are dealing with similar things today. As I talked about, really understanding issues of privilege, social justice, spirituality, using all of those things, and then, bringing our full authentic complex self to some of these practices can be confusing because it may not be what we've seen modeled, but it can be so incredibly, incredibly meaningful. Jen, if we can go to the next slide. So I wanted to just kind of wrap up, where this spiritual practice and journey took me. So after doing all of this research on my maternal ancestors and building this really strong connection to my maternal grandmothers, learning about this Mormon midwife history was all really, really powerful for me. So when in 2019, I became pregnant for the second time, and I was pregnant with my daughter. And so prior to giving birth, my midwife and doula had both encouraged me to have what's known as a mother's circle. So bringing together female supports, my sister, college friends, spiritual mentors, midwife and doula, kind of bringing everyone together. And in this circle, we talked about my journey and my maternal line and who my grandmothers were. And each of the women there offered me, just like my ancestors would have done, offered me a blessing. Or a hope or a wish for something that my physical body would need in the labor, recovery, delivery, all of these kinds of postpartum period. And it was a really, really beautiful experience to build on the traditions and the spiritual practice of these ancestors that was able to inform my current experience. I was able to go into labor labor at home with the support of two midwives and a doula and my husband, And I was able to have this really extremely healing experience from the trauma I'd experienced before. This birth trauma really was able to be redemptive and completely moved through me in a very somatic and physical way as well. With my daughter, at the moment of her birth, I was able to use my voice to roar her into the world and to bring her in this very powerful way. So that was the way that this was able to connect for me. I felt in the birth experience a distinct connection with these ancestral grandmothers. I felt them coaching the people there to say the exact right things at the exact right time that I needed to be successful in this experience. And as they did so, I felt those familiar feelings, the warm blanket feeling, the feeling of coming home that I've associated with those grandmothers so strongly. This is a picture of my daughter, and her name is Athena Rose, named Rose after the grandmothers who were midwives. So it was really, really powerful for me. Jen, if we can go to the last slide. So in this research, I found this concept of the mitochondrial DNA. So this is a portion of our DNA that is passed from mother to daughter, and that can be traced all the way back to what researchers kind of tongue-in-cheek call mitochondrial Eve, I believe is how they say it. This is a biological truth that within each of our cells, wrapped in and around the code that makes us who we are, woven through our lives, we have this tangible cellular connection with our maternal line. As I did this research and this connection, I had this really deep learning and understanding that the stories of our grandmothers are important because they are important. Not because of what they did, not because of their association with power or status or reinforcing the story of heterodoxy we want to tell ourselves. But their stories are important because they are important. And then the inverse is also true, that our stories are important because we are important, just as we are, and in all of our complexity. Thank you so much. I'd like to end there, but we have a few minutes left to if anyone has any questions.
Thank you. That was really beautiful. There is a question. So you're open to taking questions?
Yes, please.
Awesome. So the question here, there's also a heart emoji, which is great. The question here is, this session has been so beautiful. Any tips on finding details on women as you get farther back, and tips for finding primary sources?
I found that so very complicated, you know, but when we don't have even if we don't have the direct story of that woman, if we know at least date, you know, around that date and around that time, we can engage with some of the local histories and the primary sources from other people. So we, you know, just holding an awareness that isn't the story of our ancestors, but that some of those things may be things that they experienced. So for instance, kind of where I dead end right now in my maternal line is around the time of the Revolutionary War. And so even though I may not have the direct name, I can start to look at what was it like for women at that time in that area, if I have, you know, at least a generalized place. This is obviously, you know, something that's very, very difficult. But I found that as I engage with the history of the area and if you can find a local town or county history, sometimes you can get even more of those like little details. But the social history of like what was day-to-day life like, what was it like, what was their living experience like, you know, those kinds of things can give you a broader picture. So for example, the family member I have in Michigan, I didn't have a lot of information about her, but the local, it was the Mecosta, Michigan County, history went back all the way to the earliest white settlers and kind of talked about some of the traditions. So I was able to find like what were the marriage traditions at the time, what was like the fact that typically when they were building a home, on a settlement, that the woman was the person who was in charge of deciding what direction the house faced and what where the windows were, because this was kind of her purview. So she was in charge of essentially the architecture. And so I don't know that that was specific to my ancestor, but that was like a type of thing that she was engaging with and experiencing. So I hope that that kind of helps a little bit with answering that question.
That's great. And I think we have time for one more question. Let me just look and see. Can you recommend any groups people can join if they're interested in connecting with feminist genealogy practices?
That's such a wonderful question. I have been searching and I've been unable to find anyone else. In fact, I've actually had difficulty finding anyone using the term feminist genealogy. So I know that there's feminist critiques of genealogy, but I don't know that there's anyone really engaged in feminist genealogy in and of itself. So if anyone's interested in creating a group, I would absolutely love that. And, you know, I'd be happy to kind of put that together via Facebook, and maybe we could provide some support to each other. And I could share some additional tips or, you know, answer additional questions, because I have been unsuccessful at finding, any other groups doing this kind of work. I've kind of felt a little bit out on a limb by myself. So if you know of any other groups, please let me know. But otherwise, you know, maybe we just need to start that ourselves and kind of build a community for engaging in that ourselves.
Thank you again. This was such a great session and so important. Our time is up, but just want to thank everyone for attending and for supporting Sunstone. Thank you again, Ariel.
Thank you.
Bye.